Hello, and welcome to Who Runs That? Today, we'll be talking to John Stein, CEO of Betterment. Betterment is a financial advisement company that tries to bring techniques that were once reserved for wealthy people who could afford fancy advisors, techniques like rebalancing and tax loss harvesting, and brings them to the household investor at a cheaper price. In our discussion, John Stein talks about the role he feels financial companies should play in treating investors fairly. He talks about Betterment's preparedness for a potential market crash, and he reveals his thoughts about so-called alternative investments, things like maritime debt and weather futures, and whether they can provide value to the everyday saver. After the break, John Stein, CEO of Betterment. Welcome to Who Runs That? Today, we'll be talking about Betterment. We've got John Stein, the founder and CEO. He runs that. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Seth. Great to be here.
So for listeners who might not know, what is Betterment?
Betterment is an online financial advisor. We take all the things that a great financial advisor would do for you if you had one, and we make them smarter, faster, cheaper, better. So for instance, we help you tax manage your portfolio to save you up to 1.5%, say, on taxes annually, right? We help you plan and create a plan for your college savings, your retirement savings, your down payment on your house, and make sure that you have appropriate portfolios for each of those goals. And we manage them over time to manage the risk to the appropriate level for that goal. So it's financial planning, tax management, and portfolio optimization for everyone.
And so when a lot of people think about a place where they're going to put their investment money, they think of places like Fidelity and Charles Schwab. How are you different from those places?
I came from the financial services industry, and I had worked at a number of the country's largest banks and brokers. And I saw in those years, before and leading up to the financial crisis, that many of the large firms weren't really thinking about their customers. I was a customer of many of those firms as well. I had 7 different brokerage accounts throughout my life. And I was frustrated with each of them because none of them really was building products for me. They were all just selling product. They were there to make the most money for themselves, not the most for their customers. And I thought, I looked at really wealthy people and I saw really wealthy people have great financial advisors. Everyone ought to have a great financial advisor. So Betterment, unlike all the companies you just mentioned, is an advisor. We are a registered investment advisor, and that's the relationship that we have with our customers. We're a fiduciary to them. We have to put their best interests first. And so we create portfolios and manage their cash in ways that makes the most of it for them, unlike the competition.
Okay, so and when we talk about the sort of financial advisement services that maybe rich people used to get that you're maybe bringing to people who aren't quite as rich, it's things like it's rebalancing your portfolio. So if you're 60% stocks and 40% bonds, and then your stocks gain in value and your bonds lessen in value, you automatically rebalance again. And that's like a smart investment thing to do. And that's something that rich people used to have access to, but you are bringing at a lower cost to less rich people. Do I have that right?
That's a great example. Rebalancing is one of the many things that we do for you. We avoid wash sales for you, which is this complicated tax stuff that we do automatically for you in your portfolio. We asset locate for you. So we'll put the right things into your 401k and the right things into your IRA and the right things into your taxable accounts so that you can make the most of your money. No other firm does this for most people. Even most, you know, really sophisticated financial advisors don't do it as well as we do. And we work with some of the most sophisticated financial advisors. We give them our technology so that their clients can benefit from it. We charge about a quarter of what a traditional financial advisor might charge on our retail product. And we also offer advice packages and access to human advisors for an additional fee if you still want that kind of relationship. You can get it either through your own financial advisor or through one of ours.
Okay, so let's talk about how Betterment started. Let's tell the origin story. How did you get going with this idea? Where did it come from and how did you get it rolling?
Back in 2006, I was working at First Manhattan Consulting Group. I was consulting to these large banks and brokers, as I said, and I had a sense, even before I started there, that I wanted to do something to help people make better decisions. I had a background in behavioral economics, if you will. I had studied a lot of economics and psychology in college, and I was wondering how I could apply that. And in my career consulting these banks, I saw opportunities to build a more customer-centric service. And at that time, there wasn't a fintech industry, right?
Fintech means financial technology.
Technology, yeah. There weren't a lot of people doing this. And I went to business school and I had some at Columbia and I had some great professors. I think you're an alum as well, is that right?
I spent some time at Columbia Business School, yes.
And some of them gave me great advice. Many gave the advice, don't do this. This is a terrible idea, right? Especially right now as the financial world is collapsing in 2008 and 2009. And I thought, maybe this is why there's an opportunity. Customers have lost trust in these great institutions. They haven't innovated in ways that have benefited customers. And there's an opportunity now to start fresh and start a new brand that is customer-centric. And, although there wasn't a lot of support for the idea at the time, we got into TechCrunch, which is still a blog, and they had this annual meeting, and we were one of the companies chosen. We got up on stage, we made it to the final rounds, we won the best startup in New York. It was this big, exciting moment for us, and we were launched in front of 20,000 people who were watching on the webcast at that time.
What was the presentation you gave up on stage in front of thousands of people that convinced them this was a good idea?
We said we are the smarter alternative to whatever you're doing with your money today. And it was a bold claim, and we were challenged on that on stage, and people said, this seems way too simple. It's way too easy. No one's going to trust this. There's a lot of inertia in this space, and people like things that are complicated.
I think a lot of people think about this fight where on one side you've got like Elizabeth Warren and other, elected officials on the left who are trying to fight the financial industry, and then in the financial industry you have people who are trying to deregulate as much as possible and have as little fiduciary responsibility as possible. Where do you fit into that? What are your views on that mythical battle that I just invented?
There are financial firms on both sides, right? There are financial firms that are really trying to do the best thing. And listen, even I don't believe in like a strong form of good and evil. I don't believe there are just wicked people out there doing their best to rip off customers. But there are bad incentives and there are bad legacy structures and there are bad firms that just haven't adapted to the modern expectations. So in healthcare, for instance, we have a pretty strongly held belief that doctors are there to serve our best interests. In the legal world, we have the same thing. We have rules that are around how lawyers have to have your best interest in mind if you're their client. That doesn't exist in financial services. Many financial advisors, people who hold themselves out to be financial advisors, don't have their clients' best interest first, and they're selling bad product. It's not every financial advisor. There's many good financial advisors, and the good financial advisors want better regulation to make it more clear to consumers who are the good ones and who are the bad ones. And so there's lots of people on our side fighting for more transparency, appropriate short disclosure that just makes it really simple and clear in plain English to people, like, how am I getting paid? At Betterment, the only way we make money is off of the 25 basis point fee that we charge to our customers. That's it. We're almost unique in the financial world, and that's the only way that we're paid.
It's 25 basis points means 0.25%. It's a quarter of a percent. And can you explain to the lay listener who may not understand how fees work in the financial world, what does it mean when you say you're taking a quarter of a percent?
So we assess your balance every year, and we would charge 0.25% of that total balance. The average mutual fund, even today in this modern age, charges something like 1%, which would be four times that. Of course, we don't use those mutual funds. We use low-cost ETFs. Advisor fees range from as low as 25 basis points if you have a ton of money, or up to 2%+ if you don't have a lot of money. And so we are really competitively priced for the, mass market or mass affluent consumer who we think of as our core target customer. We tend to think of the people we serve as people who are making 100K a year plus, right? They're professionals. They've saved 100,000 to $500,000 and they're starting a family, or they're at least thinking about it. They may be, well into their retirement savings years, late 40s, early 50s. That's the customer that we serve from the sort of 30s to 50s. And we're helping them to craft a plan for all of their goals and to make the most of all of their money.
And for our listeners who might be a little confused by this term ETF, what is an ETF?
An ETF is an exchange-traded fund. It is like a mutual fund that trades on exchanges, and the benefit of that is that it's often lower cost because there's competition from all the different fund providers because it's traded on the exchange.
Okay, so it's basically like buying a mutual fund. It's just a little bit different. And you talked about the benefit. Are there any drawbacks to an ETF as opposed to a mutual fund?
It is just the more modern version of a mutual fund. The fund managers might say there's a drawback in that it's harder to do active management sometimes in an ETF. But for indexes, it's incredibly efficient to trade on an ETF.
So I think there's been this cultural shift away from actively managed investing. And that's where we have this genius running a mutual fund and he's making stock picks for you and you're paying him a fee for that genius that he theoretically has. And the move has been more towards these index things that are kind of more automatic and less about an individual, somewhere behind a curtain making a choice for you. That has been this cultural shift. How has Betterment fit into that shift? Is that something that was happening when you were launching Betterment? Is that something that helped you with your growth?
The shift toward index funds has been going on for decades, and it is a wind at our backs, right? This idea that active managers perform just about average on average.
But
you pay them more for it in general, right? And generally, they don't outperform net of fees. That's now well established. So we didn't have to convince customers of that. Getting low fees is a big part of the value that we offer. We not only find low fees, we also look for low transaction costs. We look for low tracking error. We select the best funds in each asset class. And we scan the entire universe of thousands of ETFs, and we're scanning it every day, all the time. And then quarterly, we'll update our portfolio. If there's a reason to choose another fund because it's lower cost, we will tax efficiently switch customers into that new fund. They'll transition over time as new cash flows come in. So there's a lot of intelligence underneath our algorithms that help you actually make the most of every dollar.
And these things can go in cycles, though. You could imagine a time in the future where active management starts to look good or to some people. Is that something you would ever consider? What would that mean for you if there was some sort of trend back towards active management?
I've never been a strong, pound the table person saying passive is the only possible way to win. I have been very strong about saying we're evidence-based. And all the evidence today says that net of fees, these index funds are the best way to invest. If active managed fees come down, I can absolutely imagine a world where there are certain strategies that could outperform. There are certain markets, say emerging markets, where there's less information, where there's possibilities for people to have better information about those, and active managers might outperform an index in some cases.
So one thing that I think Betterment tries to do is bring services that at one time were maybe only available to slightly wealthier people and bring those same kinds of slightly more complicated services to people who maybe have slightly less money. Something I've seen recently is this idea of alternative investments being brought to the household investor. And so this is a little bit complicated. We'll have to explain this, but like an alternative investment might be something like a slightly exotic bet on the outcome of a piece of litigation, or getting into like debt in the maritime industry where someone's putting out a loan to build a ship or something like that. These are things that are slightly less on the beaten path investments, but there are some places that are trying to bring those kinds of investments to the household investor, give them access to get into those kinds of investments. Is that something that you would consider doing, bringing that kind of investment to your customers?
I think all of these kinds of things are really interesting. There's democratization happening across financial services, right? And the large institutions and really wealthy investors today have access to some of these forms of investment that most retail investors don't. And
right.
I love democratization.
Right. You might need a certain amount of money to get into these crazy investments that maybe they're a little bit locked up and you need to get into them. You can only get the price to get into them is more than the average person can afford. But maybe there are some efforts to make to make those investments more accessible.
That's right. So today there's many of those investments. You have to be an accredited investor to get into them, and some of the funds have minimums. That's always frustrated me, right? That we don't give access to everything to everyone. But they're not super liquid, many of these investments, so they're not necessarily for everyone. There are reasons that we have these laws and regulations around them.
Liquid means getting my money in and out of them easily and frictionlessly, as maybe once I put my money in, it can be harder to get it out easily. Like I can't just snap my fingers and decide to take the money back out, right?
Exactly. The opposite of liquid is a lockup you can't access it. So giving some thought to how we roll these out is useful. And a lot of these markets are still early. There's not liquidity because who knows what happens in a downturn or if there's some kind of collapse. You don't know if you could get your money back from some of those less liquid things. So they're still a little bit dangerous. And I think having them in small proportions could be interesting, but generally those small proportions for the average investor who's got maybe, up to $5 or $10 million to invest, it's going to be so small that it's not going to have a meaningful impact on their overall portfolio. So I'm excited about it. I'm excited about democratization in general. But just like Bitcoin is still a little bit early for most people to spend any time thinking about it, it's a little bit early for most of these liquid alts.
Did you look into making Bitcoin and some of these other blockchain currencies available to your investors?
They're just not there yet, right? There's no real investment case or reason for those things to have long-term value as an investment yet. That's not to say it won't ever happen or it couldn't be interesting down the road, but they're way too volatile and there's no real underlying value there that you're investing in yet. The great thing about stocks and bonds, the things that we've been investing in for hundreds of years now in this country, are that they have an expected value. You're getting a dividend, you're getting some kind of expected future return on that. So you can calculate a value for the thing. And it might be overpriced, it might be underpriced relative to that value, but there is a concrete return that you're getting paid for holding it. You don't have that in Bitcoin.
So I won't be able to bet on next week's weather with Betterment in the immediate future?
Not in the immediate future, no.
Okay. Now, when you launched, it was post big recession of 2008, 2009. You have not faced a gigantic outflow of funds, a gigantic drawdown from your customers, a panic, people taking all their money out of the market. Are you ready for that?
That day or week or month or years will be painful for the entire industry, right? Mm-hmm. It happens. There are cycles in investing. And we have seen a long bull run, and there's many out there saying it's coming any day now, and maybe we're in the beginning of it, right? Lots of people seem to think so with the volatility that we've seen this year. All the research, though, and we do a lot of research on this, shows that you can't predict these things, right? All the information that we have about the future is already incorporated in current prices, and when you try to time the market, people who time the market tend to underperform the market, right? Like they tend to take their money out at the bottom and they tend to, put the money in at the top, which is the exact opposite of what you'd want to do. So we recommend staying the course, thinking about your asset allocation over a long-term horizon if you're saving for the long-term. And if you're saving for the short-term, don't put that money into stocks. Put that money into something safer that has lower volatility. The way you invest should be dictated by the goals, not by where is the market today, because where is the market today doesn't give you a lot of information about where it's going. If there is a massive downturn, we have really smart customers who have bought into this philosophy of long-term investing. Will some of them panic? Sure. And we have some safeguards in place to help them make good decisions and stay the course in that time. We have some reminders of their goals and that they can still be on track even if the market is down. And I believe that those kinds of safeguards and the fact that people can call us 7 days a week and we'll chat to them about what's right for them will help them do the right thing even in a downturn. But there's no question that downturns are painful for everyone in the financial services industry.
Have you thought about an IPO? Do you want to break news today?
No news today. We've been thinking about an IPO since day one, right? I always thought that the way to build a great institution was to make it a public company. And if we really want to do the right thing for our customers, that feels like the best path for us to continue to pursue. It's not an immediate thing. We're in here for the long term and we're building long-term value for us and for our customers.
Why do you think a public company would in the long term be better?
Because that's how we continue to focus on our mission and our customers. That's how we continue to have that be our sole focus, is by retaining our independence. And I think in the long term, the only way you can do that is to be a public company.
it could be more hassle for you, right? You people like me will suddenly get a lot more access to information about your company. You'll be responsible to activists, investors. It could be more hassle for you, no?
I relish that. We're already set up in a lot of ways to be ready for that. We're a transparent company. We don't make our financials public, but we do make our assets public and our customer accounts public. So people already know a lot about us, and everyone knows how we make money, right? So there's not anything to hide. And so I relish the idea of being really public about that. I think it'll help to build even more trust with our customer base. And we're already on that kind of quarterly reporting cycle, right? Like we're getting ready for it and maturing as a company.
So starting when if you have an entrepreneurial idea, you want to launch something, getting into financial world is a lot. There's a lot of regulation. There's a lot of rules. It could be very complicated. Why not just make hats? Like that would be simpler. Were you a little bit daunted by all the regulation and red tape you faced getting into the financial world?
Probably foolishly was not daunted by all of the regulation going into it. I just thought, I'll figure this out. I had bought something like 40 books on the law around securities markets regulation and just started reading and cross-referencing and trying to figure out what kind of entity we would have to be. I realized in the course of that it was going to take a lot of time to figure it out. And I was fortunate to have a friend who was a securities lawyer who was interested in going into business with me. That was Eli, who became one of my co-founders. And we started working together. Sean was an engineer, and he was my roommate at the time. And he was another co-founder. He helped me on the technical side. So we started bringing together all the pieces that we needed to figure this out and make it real. I relished, in some sense, the regulatory aspect of it because I realized if we could figure that out, it would be a real breakthrough and we could make something that was extremely valuable to customers in a way that, if you weren't in a regulated industry, if you were just doing another social app or, another food ordering app or whatever, not to dismiss those things, those are valuable too. But I wanted to do something that would have lasting value in people's lives and really help, help them live better. And to me, that was about, cracking one of these big regulated industries, healthcare, financial services, and improving the system.
Mm-hmm. And it's a great ambition to improve people's lives. And I want to talk a little bit about your fees, which obviously are a business decision about, how much money the business is making, and it has to do with how much you're spending. But it's also like, does it weigh on you that these fees, this is people's hard-earned savings, right? It feels a little bit different. It's people's hard-earned savings that they're putting away to save up for a house or a car or for retirement, and your fees are taking from that. And I know that's how you pay yourself and that's the industry and it's not, but does that keep you up at night? How much do those decisions about, because I know that your fees have also, you've changed them at different times, at least since I've been a customer. Those decisions, how do those weigh on you, and how do you think about them in terms of how that affects your customers?
I do think about it. I know that our fees are lower than anyone who provides comparable services, right? And I know that we are helping customers make more than what we charge in fees because of the tax savings that we give them, right? So we're actually creating value, right? There's most financial advisors would say that they're creating value, but I can demonstrate it with math. Mm-hmm. I can show you exactly how much extra return you're getting for using Betterment. And to me, I feel great about that. I mean, it's a service that I use. It's a service that I recommend to all my friends and family. And I created it because I believe that we actually are, net of fees, net of everything that we do, creating more value for our customers and making the most of our customers' money more than anybody else.
In those times when you have changed the fee structure, why has that been? What has gone into the need to change it?
So when we first started out, we charged 90 basis points, just under 1%. And we thought that seems to make sense. That's sort of less than the average advisor. And we're providing a lot of advice services and helping to manage things.
Can we break down, just for the lay listener who may not be great at math? So let's say I've invested $10,000 with you and you were taking 90 basis points. That's 0.9%, 0.9%. What does that mean to their $10,000?
So I guess on $10,000, that would be $90 a year that you're paying.
Okay.
And again, that was lower than the average mutual fund cost. It was lower than the average advisory cost. But, we decided after a year or so in business that it was still high, right? Like we're getting customers and we were finding that we could serve them really inexpensively. And so we cut the fee substantially. We cut it to 35 basis points and it was tiered down from there. And today our fee is 25 basis points. We just leveled it at 25 basis points for everyone. And except at, I think, greater than 2 million, it tiers to 15 basis points.
So that's a quarter of a percent. So on my $10,000, that would be $25 a year you're taking.
Correct.
Right.
Okay. Correct.
Oh, and I just wanted to clarify. And so the ETFs that you're investing in, they are also charging their own fees for people's money to be in there. Your fee is what you're charging to do things like rebalance people's portfolio, take the tax loss harvesting services like that. That's your fee, that your portion that you're taking.
That's right.
Okay. And tell me about your own investment history. You mentioned you've been with seven different investment services. What kind of investor are you?
I started out as a relatively active investor. I was managing a portfolio of individual stocks and bonds. And I think a lot of people have this kind of DIY approach when they're young. Certainly, before there was Betterment, there wasn't another option, right? Like you just had to go out and sort of figure things out on your own. And I was reading all the sites and research and trying to figure it out, reading the papers. I found that I was just about average as an investor, right? I found it out through practice. I made some great investments. I had some real winners in my portfolio. I also made some terrible investments. I bought Enron on the way down, which I like to point to as a classic example of something I thought I was getting a great deal on because I bought it when it was really low, but you know, it went even lower. It went to zero. And so,
what was your risk tolerance like? What is your risk tolerance?
I had a high risk tolerance. I was young 20s then. I was investing a little bit of graduation money that I had gotten. And so I was, I learned in that time that I was subject to the same kinds of biases and mistakes that I'd learned about in college in my behavioral economics kind of training. I was no different from everybody else. And it was great to have that experience because that set me on the path of thinking I should just diversify and not spend so much time doing this, and I should tax manage and I should do all the smart things that I know are the right thing to do for the long term for my money. And I was so frustrated that I couldn't find a service that just did all of that. It was obvious what to do, right? It wasn't super complicated, but none of the institutions had an incentive to do that because they were all getting paid for recommending only their funds or getting paid based on the transactions that I made. I thought it would be great if there was a service that was paid instead just to do what was right for me. And that was some of the genesis for Betterment.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of wealth inequality in the United States right now, and the trend has been bad on wealth inequality. Do you think companies like Betterment have any role to play in mitigating wealth inequality or have any responsibility with regard to wealth inequality and how that happens and how that changes?
I think this wealth inequality is one of the great challenges of our time, right? The fact that it's increasing is troubling in this country. I'm reading a great book right now called Factfulness. You may have seen this. It's fantastic. It's about how over the long term, over the last 50 years, say, in general, the world population is getting healthier and richer and much better off. And I recognize there are major problems that we have to solve in terms of wealth inequality and things, but I'm also an optimist. And I believe that the pendulum swings back and forth on equality to inequality, but our democracy will figure out ways to return to more of an equilibrium over time. I believe in the entrepreneurial spirit of the American people and that we will find ways to change policy to make more for the entire country, for all the people of America. I think this is a great country, and I think we set an example for the world, and the world has been getting better. In part as a result of our example, and I want to continue to see that over time. We can't solve every problem today at Betterment, but we can be a voice for change and a voice for what we think is right, and I think we do have a role to play there.
Mm-hmm. Any specifics about the kind of role you can play?
We are advocating in Washington for a number of investor and customer-friendly policies. We believe in data transparency, for instance. We believe you should own all your financial data. And that's something we've been going to the mat about in so many conversations with different agencies and talking to congresspeople and senators to make sure that you continue to own your financial data, just like you ought to own your own medical records, right? If you don't own your own medical records, you can't change doctors. You're locked in. Only one person has all your information. You could never leave because they know everything about you. It's the same in financial services. If you don't own your transaction history, your tax basis and all your things, if you don't have access to that and you aren't able to port it, you can't leave your provider because they own you. So to me, it's important that we have access to our own data. It's one of the many things that we're advocating for on behalf of investors.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break now. After the break, we'll be back with more from John Stein, CEO of Betterment. I'm going to move on to our lightning round. Are you ready?
I don't think so.
You mentioned one book you were recently reading, but I'm wondering, are there any particular books or movies that have informed how you manage people or how you run an organization?
So many. One of my favorites in terms of how we think about our customers is Thinking Fast and Slow by Dan Kahneman. If you haven't read it, I've read it twice now. It's an incredible read on human psychology and how people make decisions.
Meetings. Are you pro or con? How do you run your meetings, or do you just not have meetings?
Always have an agenda. I find myself in meetings a lot, and I like Andy Grove's high output management, which talks about like that's actually pretty high leverage time if you have like the right people in the room and have a good agenda and have clear decisions coming out of it.
What was the most interesting thing you learned at Columbia Business School?
I learned a management style. I learned to be collaborative in my approach. I took a great class called High Performance Management, and we had small groups, and we would role play in the group in some situation. And I learned just to gather all the information before making a decision, right? I had maybe a hypothesis going in that you have to be like quick and decisive and, you know, move fast. And what I learned in there is that's often not going to lead to the best decision. You want to take your time, only decide when you have to, gather as much information as you can before you make a decision.
What mistake have you made in the past that you've learned the most from?
Wow.
Don't say Enron.
That was a big one. You know, in the early days, I thought that I would literally do everything at Betterment. I decided, my initial business plan, I was the only employee, and I just thought I was going to learn how to do it all. Over time, I've learned that you have to build a team. You have to do things with a team. You have to hire amazing people and delegate as much as possible and just get out of the way. And I continue to learn about that, right? It's a constant challenge, I think, as a CEO to give away as much as possible. And I think back to those early days when I thought I would do everything and like, what a foolish mistake that was. And that kind of guides me in thinking about how I have to always get out of the way.
If I told you tomorrow that you're fired and you can never again be an executive or do anything even remotely related to what you're doing right now, what would you do with your life?
I'd start by traveling and spending a lot of time with my kids.
Where would you travel to?
I'd go around the world. I mean, I'd go to Asia. I would spend some time in Africa. I'd spend some time in Europe. I would.
And you would take your kids with you and your and tell me a little bit about your family.
So I've got a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old daughter. We've actually been to most of those places with them already. So
That's ambitious with young children.
Yeah, we took Sasha to Japan when she was like 10 months old. We've taken both of them to Australia and Singapore and India on an around the world trip. I love traveling with them because it's one of the ways that I get to really disengage from my life as a CEO where I'm always on. When I'm, you know, that far remote, I'm just with them and I get to really be present with my family and thinking about the trip and thinking about what we're doing next. And that helps me be present with them. And so I value that time. And then I'd probably do something. I mean, I've always been interested in neuroscience. I did a post-bac pre-med year after college. I loved the science of it. I think that would be an interesting spot to spend a few years, right? Because I think there's so much interesting innovation going on around the brain and we're learning so much these days.
John Stein, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Seth. It's been great being here.
That's our show for today. Who Runs That is produced by Cameron Drews and Cleo Levin. The senior producer for Slate Podcasts is TJ Raphael. The editorial director of Slate Podcasts is Gabriel Roth. If you like the show, please rate and review us in Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. I'm Seth Stevenson. Thanks for listening.